All right, so we're talking about 1 and 2 Kings, and we kind of talked intro-wise about what this book originally looked like. We've kind of split it up, right? You know, in the Greeks kind of did that, and we've kind of followed that same kind of tradition. But 1 and 2 Kings originally was what? Like one long scroll, lots of sheep, all rolled up and written on, right? So that was originally what it was. And we've kind of broken it up because it's more easy that way, right? When it's in book form. That way it's not so like Moby Dick-esque as far as just being gargantuan. So we're going to kind of treat it as one book. We're not going to do another introduction when we get to 2 Kings because it would be the same introduction again. So the whole outline and everything is going to be covering both books. And in dealing with 1 Kings, as we talked about in Samuel, we talked about transition. And in 1 Kings, we transition into what? Do you remember what we do at the very end? 1 Kings starts with what phrase? About David. David's old. He's an old man. And so we're starting a transition into who is going to reign now instead of King David. Solomon, right? Which, side note, did you know that like his name pronounced in the Hebrew is Shlomo? Literally, that's his name in Hebrew, Shlomo, which is a little less regal in my opinion, right? So we'll just keep it Solomon. But Solomon is going to be reigning, and there's a little bit of turmoil with the transition. What was the turmoil with the transition with Solomon? Do you remember? His brother, those pesky brothers. Anybody have brothers? Okay, yeah, everybody knows. So he kind of wanted... You know, technically he was the older brother, but everybody knew that Solomon, God had given Solomon kind of the reign to be next in order. And he tried to kind of be pesky about it twice, so much so that he lost his life over the issue. He was brought out and killed, pounced upon by the leader of the armies. And so chapter 3, we begin Solomon's kingdom at the end of chapter 3 is kind of firmly established in the end of chapter 2. Chapter 3 kind of gives us a blip, kind of intro to Solomon's reign as we kind of looked at very hastily rather last Wednesday. And now we start sort of getting into the reign of Solomon. And we're going to be looking at the first few chapters, the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon's sort of known for that, right? Three W's that Solomon is known for. Can you guess what they are? Wisdom, women, and wealth, right? Those are some things that Solomon is sort of known for. And we're going to be talking about Solomon's wisdom. And as we begin here, the kingdom went just quickly in verse 3. I wanted to touch this. We didn't have time to deal with this. Verse 3 of chapter 3 says, "Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father." With a caveat. What's the caveat there? Except he burned incense on the high places. What is that in reference to? There were other religions. Now, it is not... So to be fair, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was offering incense to foreign gods. What it could be also is that he was offering incense to God, but on the high places, which was not acceptable either. Neither one were acceptable. There was a place to do those things, right? There was a certain way to worship God and approach God. And mixing up this concept of pagan religion and God and worshiping God wasn't acceptable either. We can tell neither one of them were accepted. And except he offered burnt incense on the high places. And we'll get to some more things that he did incorrectly, but that sort of is a little caveat there to his how he reigned. And so the king goes to Gibeon, and in Gibeon there he offers sacrifices. Verses chapter 3, verses 4 through 15, we have the explanation of Solomon's wisdom, how he ruled, why he was wise. And he goes there and he offers 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar in Gibeon. And the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night because he was sleeping at night. And what does God say?
You want to know what shall I give you?
Ask what you wish me to give to you. Now, this sounds a lot like what? Like a genie situation, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get a wish, but you can't wish for more wishes. What's happening here? God, he makes these sacrifices to God on the altar there in Gibeon. And incidentally, Gibeon at this time is where the tent of meeting was. And also that's where the bronze altar was. But the ark was actually in Jerusalem. And we'll see that in just a moment. But he goes there to make the offerings. And God says, ask me what you will of me, essentially. And what does Solomon do? He has this prayer. So it's a dream, but it's one of those dreams that you can interact with. And so he's interacting. God appeared to him in this form. And he asks for something specifically. And he prays. And in his prayer, what does he say about God and about himself in relationship to the kingdom? What is brief synopsis? What do you guys see there when you peruse his prayer? What are some things he's saying? I'm sorry? You've shown me mercy, right? He also talks about David showing, God showing loving kindness to David and the kingdom, right? What else does he say about himself in relationship to ruling this nation? He said, I'm a child, right? He said, I don't know how to go in or come out without any kind of direction. What's interesting, too, is he says, you have made your servant. And he talks about your people, your servant, and he's giving God ownership. So he's humble about what he's saying. He's giving God ownership, which is putting God in his proper place. And so he says, so give your servant, verse 9, he says, give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? It is estimated, some have said he was as young as like 12 or 14. Tradition says he's 12. It's estimated that he was 17 or 18 at the time of this, an estimation. And so he's saying, give me wisdom. So it's obvious that he has a touch of wisdom, right? To ask for more wisdom. David, even in his dying comments to Solomon, makes comments about his wisdom, right? He says, judge according to your wisdom, in his dying comments to his son. And so it is obvious that he has something there. But he asks for more wisdom. And verses 10 through 15, God responds with what? What does he say? Yeah, so you didn't ask for what everybody would normally ask for. What are the things that he lists here that you would normally ask for in verses 10 through 12, essentially? What does he say? Yeah, that's the American dream, right? That's what you should be asking for. Yes, ma'am. I want a car. I want a fast chariot. No, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there was some discernment in Solomon. David was wise for his age as well, and obviously passed that on to his son. There was some training there. So parents, obviously we don't know much about, the parents were involved in obviously giving him that. And so he didn't ask for long life, didn't ask for riches, didn't ask for the life of your enemies. But you've asked for discernment. It says, verse 12, behold, I have done according to your words. Whatever he did, I've done that. I've given you a wise and discerning heart. So there will be what? None like you before you, nor shall one like you rise after you. I've also given you what you have not asked for, riches and honor. There will not be any among the kings like you in all your days. Condition. So much implication with those two letters, right? If you walk in my ways, keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. So I'm giving you these things. But on top of that, if you order now, I will give you I'll prolong your days if you'll walk in my statutes, just like your father David did. Now, does he say that David never messed up, that David ever... No, he's not saying that. We know about David. We know his blemishes. He did mess up, but he had a heart that was walking close with God. And that's what he's asking David to, or Solomon here to do. David told Solomon, do this, make sure you do this. And so these are everything points back to that. 15, Solomon wakes up. It was a dream, and he goes to Jerusalem, goes to the ark, where the presence of God is, and to the covenant of the Lord, and offered burnt offerings there, and made peace offerings there as well. So basically cleansing himself, trying to make himself pure in that situation. And then we have, beginning of verse 16, this demonstration of wisdom. We kind of have a series of events that demonstrate Solomon's wisdom after receiving said wisdom, it being, you know, downloaded into Solomon. In some way, he now has this wisdom. And verses 16 through 28, we have a situation arises, and Solomon wisely judges the situation. Some of you may know what the situation is. Some of you can peruse it really quickly. What happens in these next few verses that demonstrates the wisdom of Solomon? A situation arises. He's judging on the throne, and a situation comes up. What's the situation? What are the details? Can y'all give me the cliff notes of this? Two people are fighting over a baby. A custody battle, okay? Two women are fighting over a baby. One says it's mine, the other one says, no, it's mine. What are the circumstances behind? One of the babies died. One lady says, well, she rolled over and killed her baby, and then swapped the babies as though I would know that it was not mine. And took mine. And so one has this accusation. The other one says, no, it was mine the whole time. You know, your name wasn't on it. It's mine. So there's this and they're going back and forth. No, it's mine. And what is David's or Solomon's response in verse 24? He doesn't even say anything. Get me my sword, right? That's the response of King Solomon. And the ladies are like, what? I can imagine that everybody in the courtroom is like, Solomon? What? Sword? Okay. Get me my sword. And a sword. And the sword is presented, and he says what? That's logical, right? That's men's waffle brain thinking. Just cut it in half. Give one, you know, I'm done. I'm tired of dealing with this, right? Cut it in half. Why was he doing that? Would the real mother please stand up? Right? And that's what she did. She said, no, the real mom's not going to want the baby to die no matter what. Does not want the baby to die. And so she says, no, just let her have it. And then he discerns who is the actual mother. And everybody's like, whoa, mind blown, right, at that time. And everybody, in verse 28 is the mind blown verse. When all Israel heard the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Yes, sir. Yes, that's the voice of evil, right?
She wants the other woman to suffer the same pain that she
has. Yes, hurt wants company. Misery wants company. That's a good lesson there with this one. She wanted the other person to suffer. If I can't have a baby, you can't have one either. They live together. They are roommates, but I don't think they're besties after this. So in this situation, we see the wisdom, the judgment of Solomon in dealing with this. We also see Solomon in his administerial wisdom in chapter 4. In basically the first six verses, he talks about his court or his officials. And Solomon names these different officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, was the priest. Eliab, then we have the secretaries. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, who incidentally, 2 Samuel 8:16, was also the recorder for David. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the army. Zadok with Abathar were priests. Azariah, the son of Nun, Nathan, were over the deputies. Now, which Nathan that is, we don't know. We're not sure which Nathan that was. But he was the son of Nathan. And then we have also another son of Nathan, a priest, was the king's friend. Incidentally, the word priest, they're like, well, there's a lot of priests there. The word priest can be in an administerial context, it can be advisor. It doesn't always mean priests. Here in this context, they translated all priests, but it also can mean advisor if you're wondering, well, how many priests are there? So that could be another translation there, as advisor to the king. And then Ahashire was over the household, and Aaron the son of Abda was over the men subject to forced labor. And we'll get to that shortly about forced labor. And then he begins to appoint deputies in verse 7. I don't know if I have this broken up. Yes, I do. Look at there. So organized. Okay. So then he begins to talk about these deputies. In verses 7 through 20, he names 12 deputies, which we kind of have alluded to. Azariah, the son of Nathan, was over the deputies, right? And then if you want to like scan over and fast forward to verse 27 of chapter 4, we have these deputies providing for Solomon. And so according to each in his month. And so apparently these were organized. These each had a month in order that they were to collect taxes and things from the people is what we're kind of gathering from this. And so we have the deputies. They have their names and then the area that they were over in charge of, which incidentally in verse 8, who's listed there? Just saying. Ben-Hur was here. So that means son of Hur. Him, anyway. So that's a fun name. So there's several different people who are listed here. The regions that they were over. Look in verse 11. We have two of these situations, verse 11 and verse 15. Benida and all the eighth of Dor. Tapheth, the daughter of Solomon, was his wife. So this list was amassed later on. Okay. Obviously, I mean, we're writing about events that took place. Either Solomon already had a daughter who was old enough to be married, or we're writing about something later on. This is kind of a side note. Incidentally, this guy, you know, so we're writing about this guy prior, and he mentions in there that later on this guy marries the daughter of Solomon. And so that's kind of interesting as well. And then we have that mentioned again in verse 15, that another daughter was married to one of these deputies. And so the deputies are listed, and the areas that they're in charge of are listed. And so all of that is listed out there in verses 7 through 20. And 20 kind of gives us this concept that Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance, and they were eating and drinking and rejoicing. So they were obviously gathering from these people, but still they had resources. This land that they're in, the land of Canaan, was supposed to be a what? A land flowing with milk and honey, right? And so this is kind of alluding to the fact that we're not literally milk and honey, but we're talking about agricultural kind of concepts. That this is a land of plenty is kind of what we're talking about here. And they had that in this situation. And it says, verse 21, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of Philistines to the border of Egypt and brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. 21 through 34, we have the extent of power and his rule. If you want to write out there too, the Genesis 15, 18, as far as the land promise is being fulfilled here, there are some people saying, well, the land promise was never fulfilled. And so, and the premillennial argument is that it was never fulfilled, that we're still waiting for a kingdom, physical kingdom on earth. This verse says that it was fulfilled, that land promise was fulfilled. So we have those, and even back-to-back, the two promises as far as the great multitude of people and the land promise are mentioned here back-to-back. Verse 22, we have Solomon's like provision, like what he needs. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over everything west of the river, and talks about his dominion again. Now, I don't. Do you guys go shopping using cores as a unit of measurement? I don't. Sometimes I feel like my list is like that. I remember when I was growing up, we used to have like two. There's four boys in the house. We had like two shopping carts to go up to. I was like, oh, we're gonna be here forever. But this isn't even close, right? I mean, your shopping list probably isn't like this. And so this is his shopping list. This is a basically 340 bushels of fine flour and 155 bushels of meal, which weight of a bushel is like 41.5 pounds. It's estimated that this amount of food could feed between, depending on their appetites, between some have estimated as low as 14,000, some as high as 30,000 people that this could feed in a day, depending on diets and stuff. So that's a day's grocery bills. It's a lot, okay? So they were eating a lot over there. So this is kind of going through, talking again about Solomon. And then he talks about in verse 26, 25, so Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and fig tree from Dan to Beersheba all the days of Solomon. Why is this different than the reign of David? Every man dwelt in safety, in peace and tranquility. David, it was like on the other side. David was really trying to establish, you know, pushing out people, establish a kingdom. He got his hands dirty and clearing all the rowdy people out, right? And then Solomon kind of built on that. And it's really, really brought the kingdom into its golden years on the back of the work that Solomon had done. Obviously with the blessing of the Lord. But the God had told him that he would be a person of peace, and every man dwelt under his vine, under his fig tree. You could, you know, you didn't have to lock your doors, just like the olden days. So it was a time of peace and tranquility. We have here, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses, or his chariots, and 12,000 horsemen. In verse 27, the deputies, again, as we mentioned before, or providing. They also provide a barley and straw for the horses, the swift steeds. So this is talking about all the things that are, you know, what Solomon has done. If you want to write out there Deuteronomy 17:16. Deuteronomy 17:16. When they said, when you have a king, your king is not to do what with horses? Not to multiply for himself horses. You're not supposed to multiply this huge vast army as though you were anything without God. Deuteronomy 17:16. And then verse 29. Now God gave Solomon wisdom, very great discernment, and breadth of mind, like the sand that is on the seashore. What is up with saying like the sand that is on the seashore? What does that mean? That's a fancy way of saying a lot, right? And so what is a commentary on the wisdom of Solomon here? These kind of, he's got a lot of it. He's got a lot. We understand sand, right? It's so annoying, sand. It's like all over. And if you've got dark interior in your car, it's all over the place. And this guy has wisdom in spades, is basically what he's saying here. And wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the East. Incidentally, the word for, so there's three things mentioned. The word wisdom here, the first word, is practical wisdom. We would say he was very savvy. And the second kind of word that's used there is very great discernment, ability to arrive at a solution to difficult problems. And then this breadth of mind. What does the King James say there instead of breadth of mind? What is the King? Anybody King James? New King James? Anybody? Old King James, either one. Breadth of mind in verse 20. Okay, yes. In verse 29, breadth of mind like the sand. Basically, this is the comprehensive knowledge. He knew a lot about a lot. Wisdom. So these kind of different ways of saying how smart he was. And then he talks about being wise. His wisdom surpassed all the sons of the East, which is sort of a proverbial place that wisdom comes from, and his wisdom was greater than that of Egypt. The Egypt that was building pyramids and geography and all those kinds of, his wisdom was greater than that, and his wisdom was greater than these four men that we know essentially nothing about. This Ethan is accredited for writing Psalm 89, and He-Man, incidentally, any fans of He-Man, incidentally wrote Psalm 88. So we have this really, those two psalms are credited to their writing, but that's really all we know about these people. But his fame, basically what we're saying is his wisdom surpassed all known wise people and places, is what we're trying to get out here, at the extent of Solomon's wisdom. As we go through the end of this chapter, he says, he also spoke 3,000 proverbs. and the songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in the Lebanon, even to the hyssop and grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And so as far as the wisdom of Solomon that we have written down, we have what in reserve? Or what do we have recorded in our Bibles from Solomon? We have Proverbs, Song of Solomon that, you know, we really don't study in church. And then what else? Ecclesiastes, okay? So according to, if this was the sum of everything he wrote, we have less than a third of what he is accredited to writing here. Not saying that he didn't do it, just saying that's what we have. Also, there were two psalms that are accredited to him, Psalm 72 and Psalm 127. But we have very little recorded in relationship to the vast, what is saying here. So again, these two chapters want to talk about the wisdom of Solomon and how his reign starts. And then this next section, we're going to start getting into Solomon's work. It's only the first 11 chapters that we really deal with Solomon. And chapters 5 through the end of chapter 7, we talk about his work. And what is it that Solomon is accredited to doing that it's funny to look at your wrist expecting there to be a watch, and there's nothing. So what is Solomon accredited to building? The temple. The house of the Lord. David couldn't do it because why?
He shed too much blood.
He couldn't do that. And so chapter 5, verses 1 through 18, we have these preparations for the building of the temple. Now, David had already done some preparation, right? He'd already started putting together a bunch of gold and bronze and cedars of Lebanon and all that kind of stuff. And David had already began, if you want to write it there, 1 Chronicles chapter 29, 2 through 5, kind of mentions that. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, 2 through 5. And so he goes to Hiram. Hiram is, as said here in verse 1, has always been a friend of David. It was Hiram that built David's house in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Solomon says to him that, Lord has given me rest on either side. He says, I don't have any adversary or misfortune. And he says, I intend to build the house of the name of the Lord my God. And he goes down, if you want to follow on down, in verse 6, he says, now therefore command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will give you wages for your servants according to all that you say. For you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. So he needs lumber from up north to build the temple, because they have like scrub brushes in that area. They don't have the timber like that they need to build the temple like he plans on doing. And so he contacts Hiram, who's the king of Tyre, and he says, hey, you know what? We had a good working relationship with my dad. You know, everything's going good down here. Hope it's going good for you up there. I need some wood. Can you send me some wood? And then he says, I'll pay you for it. And then he says also, nobody cuts wood like you guys. Just like, hey, you know, you compliment them, right, when you want to ask for something. If you go to the lumber yard and say, hey, this is some good-looking lumber, and you compliment people, then you ask for something, right? That's how you do it. And so Solomon's very wise in his dealing with this individual. And even this guy, Hiram, says what about David? He says, he's so glad, in verse 7, blessed is the Lord today who has given David a wise son over this great people. And so Hiram does that. And Hiram says, you know what, I'm going to cut timber, I'm going to take it to the ocean, and we're going to float it down in rafts to wherever you want it, and we'll cut it up, and we'll haul it across the land to you, because that's the easiest way to move lumber, because it floats. And did you know, incidentally, we've done that a ton out west in the cutting of timber in the Pacific. So it's something that they did then. We don't do it anymore because, anyway, we don't do it anymore, but we used to do it all the time. So they do it here, and he talks about what he's going to do, and then he talks about the things he's going to do to pay this guy. He says 2,000 bushels or 20,000 cores of wheat. 2,000 bushels. That is a lot. Where are they getting all this stuff? And so they basically give him all this food for his household. And he also, 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 10, talks about how he also paid what he did to pay for the people who were working as well. And he paid them year by year. In verse 12, the Lord gave wisdom to Solomon, just as he had promised, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a covenant. It is possible that they made a covenant by marriage, because 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1, mentions that he was in love with foreign women, and actually mentions Sidonian as one of the women that he was in love with, and so it's possible that this pact was sealed with marriage. It doesn't say that here, but it's possible that it was. And so here we have verse 13. We begin the work. I'm not even doing this up here for you guys. I'm sorry. There you go. Now you know where we are. And so we begin this building of the temple in chapter 5. He talks about forced labor in verse 13. And he numbered 30,000 men and talks about how they rotated. And these are men of Israel. And then he talks about other people that were brought into forced labor. So these other people were probably the Canaanites that were left in the land that were forced into labor. And so that continues there. Yes, sir? Labor force? Labor force? Forced labor?
An army of labor is
not. Okay. I'll look into that and get back to you on it. Yes, I understand what you're saying. I'm pesky New American Standard translators. I'll talk to them about it. Not that kind of force, no. There's no midichlorian levels here at all, no. Mm-mm. So in this situation, I'll look into that. I mean, that's a good question. Just changing those around, it changes the sentiment there. Now, they were not supposed to make slaves. They were not supposed to make slaves of
the labor force was 30,000 men.
Yes, and New American Standard says forced laborers numbered. So, conscripted. I will look into the Hebrew on that and get back to you on that question. But that is very good, because they're not supposed to make forced labor of the Israelites. Yes, ma'am.
King James says, raise the levy.
Raise the levy, yes. Yep. That's literally what it's levied. Levied forced laborers is what it says here. And we're not going very fast in this. So they put this labor force together, and we'll talk about how they did that later on. I'll look into that. Very good question. And but they talks about the deputies that were involved in basically this labor force and everything that was done and the things that were quarried and the cut stones and all everything that was done in preparation for this. Chapter 6, if you want to put out there, 2 Chronicles chapter 3 corresponds with chapter 6. And they begin to build. And it came about in 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. We have a time stamp here in chapter 6, verse 1. And we have this building. And verses 2 through 10 talk about the exterior of the temple. It was about 90 feet by 30 feet by 40 feet high, 45 feet high. And of course, they used cubits, which a cubit is the basic measurement from your elbow to the middle of your finger, which if it's a standard cubit, it is 18 inches, is the standard cubit. So some of you will be going home and measuring your elbow to your finger tonight to see if you are standard cubit length. So that's basically the unit of measurement here, and 90 feet by 30 feet by 40 feet high was the temple and as it constructed. And I think I have a picture here, because pictures are awesome. Where'd it go? There it is. Can y'all see that? So here's a guesstimation. As you read through this chapter, we get some details about measurements, but the exact details we don't have. So this is a guesstimation of what the temple looked like. We have some details, but not everything. Just like the ark, we have some details of the ark, but we don't have all the details. We have a guesstimation of what the ark looks like. The Ark of the Covenant and the ark that Noah was in for a while. And so in this situation, this is an estimation of what it looks like. And so verses 2 through 10 talk about the exterior. Verses 11 through 14 talk about this promise of God. So God talks to Solomon again. He says, if, condition, you walk in my statutes and execute my ordinances and keep my commandments, by walking in them, then I will carry out my word with you, which I spoke to David, your father, and I will dwell among the sons of Israel and will not forsake my people. Why is dwelling, what is the concept of dwelling among the people, why is that important as you're building a temple to God? Yeah, and that's where God's physically going to be. The physical, the Shekinah glory of God is going to be in the temple. He said, I will be there if you guys do what you're supposed to do. If you're not, I'm not going to be there. You can come knocking, but I'm not going to be there. So, and so you will not, I will forsake them in that case. And so verses 15 through 35, we have explanation of the interior. We have the concept of how it was paneled and separated off. We have the sanctuary or the inner Holy of Holies is 30 by 30 by 30 feet. This kind of perfect square cube. Incidentally, this is double the size that was in the tabernacle. Verses 28 or 23 through 28, we have these two cherubim who are on either side, made out of olive wood. Everything in this is covered in what? Gold. Everything is covered in gold. The walls were actually plated gold. You may be thinking, well, it's gilded like the edges of my Bible. No, it is plated like hammered plate gold on the walls in a lot of places. Some of it was gilded specifically, but a lot thicker probably than what's on the edges of your Bible. And so, yes, sir? Do you have a question? Okay. So we're talking about all this gold. Everything is covered in gold. You can see from the picture there that it's kind of shiny. My question is, who polishes that? You know, that's what I would be thinking. And who polishes like the Holy of Holies? That would be kind of scary. So we don't get that detail, incidentally. That's not in the Bible. So 29 through 30, we have these carved walls and the decorations that are there. 31 through 35, the temple doors. And as I read some people talking about the translating, some of this is kind of ambiguous. Even translating, the translators translating it from the Hebrew are like, I'm not exactly sure what they did with those chains. Or if that's exactly, so some of it was very ambiguous as to what it was. But all of that, the basic concept is it was lavish, okay? The estimation of cost in today's value is around, in just silver and gold, not manpower, not any of that kind of thing, is estimated around $216 billion in silver and gold that was used in making of these things. That's not manpower, that's not the bronze, that's not any of the other kind of stuff. That is a lot of money going into the building of this temple. Everything was gilded and everything was involved in that. And we'll get into talking about some other construction things later on next Wednesday. Any questions, comments before we begin or finish up? All right, thank you very much for your time this evening.